Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine for just a moment that you're in an environment of absolute, just unimaginable torment.
Right.
The kind of suffering that is so pervasive, it literally obliterates any concept of a self or a future.
Yes.
You are just raw, continuous pain. And this is, well, it's the traditional depiction of the hell realms.
Exactly.
Now imagine that into this suffocating darkness, a single ray of light pierces through. It actually touches you.
Mm-hmm.
And for just a fraction of a second, the pain stops.
Mm-hmm.
You look up and you recognize the source of this light, the Buddha. And you feel this one fleeting, totally involuntary surge of relief and gratitude. A single moment of pure trust.
Yeah, and according to the teachings we're exploring today, that single, almost microscopic moment of trust is so phenomenally powerful that it instantly severs the karma that's anchoring that being to the hell realm.
Wow.
They pass away and they transmigrate upward. It completely rewrites their trajectory for eons.
See, that story, it always stops me in my tracks. Because when we usually hear the word trust or, faith in a spiritual context, it comes with so much baggage.
Oh, absolutely. Tons of baggage.
We think of it as blind submission, right? Mm-hmm. Like a leap in the dark where you just turn off your critical thinking and hope the universe catches you.
Right.
But what we're looking at today, it completely shatters that definition.
It really does. We're looking at a faculty of the mind that is, well, it's the absolute antithesis of blind surrender. In the Tibetan tradition, the word is dadpa, and in Sanskrit, it's prasada.
Okay.
And it implies this incredibly lucid, rigorous, and deeply clarifying force. It's an active technology of the mind.
That is beautifully put. So, welcome everyone to this Dharma teaching. Today, we are stepping into a shared space to explore a truly remarkable text from the Tibetan Buddhist canon, specifically the Dzogchen Kangyur.
Yes.
It's called Cultivating Trust in the Great Vehicle, which is also known as the Noble Great Vehicle Sutra.
And it's an incredible privilege to sit with this text today.
It really is.
Because for centuries, this was preserved only in Tibetan. It had been translated from Sanskrit back in the late 8th or maybe early 9th century by Indian preceptors like Jina Mitra.
Right.
Working alongside the Tibetan translator Yeshe Day. And the only reason we can actually discuss it in English today with all of you is because of the 84,000 Project.
Yes, such an amazing group.
Which is this monumental, global, nonprofit initiative that's basically translating the entirety of the Buddha's words.
Yeah, to bring these ancient, meticulously preserved words into our modern practice is a really rare opportunity. So let's kind of set the stage for you. The sutra places us on Vulture Peak Mountain.
In Ajigaya, yeah.
Right, the Buddha Sakyamuni is there. But he's surrounded by this staggering retinue. The text actually lists 5,000 bodhisattva great beings.
That's a massive assembly.
Huge. And these are beings whose minds are completely unstained by worldly phenomena. We're talking about figures named Clear Trust, Stainless Trust, Unwavering Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And alongside them, there are thousands of monks, gods, nagas, non-human beings.
Mm.
It's just an ocean of realized and semi-realized beings.
It is. But I think the pivotal detail for us as practitioners is who the Buddha is actually talking to in this massive crowd.
Right.
Because he doesn't direct this teaching at the fully awakened Buddhas. And he doesn't aim it at the people completely disconnected from the Dharma either. He targets a really specific cross-section.
The novice bodhisattvas.
Exactly. Specifically, those dwelling on what the text calls the level of devoted engagement.
I think we really need to ground that term. Let's break that down.
Yeah, please.
Because if you're on the level of devoted engagement, which correlates to the paths of accumulation and preparation in the Mahayana framework, you're basically someone who cares deeply.
Right.
You've studied. You've generated bodhicitta, that altruistic intention to awaken for the benefit of all beings. But crucially, you haven't yet hit the path of seeing.
Yes, that non-conceptual direct breakthrough into emptiness.
Exactly. You haven't tasted it directly.
Which means you are still operating largely through concepts. You have the map and you believe the map is accurate, but you haven't actually walked the territory yourself yet.
Right.
And because of that gap between conceptual understanding and direct realization, vulnerable. Yeah.
You grapple with doubts.
You do. Your practice fluctuates. You might misinterpret teachings when things get really difficult. So the Buddha is speaking directly to the committed yet somewhat fragile practitioner.
He's speaking to us.
Yes.
And there's immense compassion in that framing, right? He sees the devotion, but he also clearly sees the instability.
Absolutely.
And the catalyst for the entire teaching is a bodhisattva named Great Skillful Trust, who essentially steps forward from this giant assembly, kneels down, and asks four fundamental questions.
Right.
He asks, first, what are the characteristics of this trust in the great vehicle? Second, how is it actually developed? Third, what are its classifications? And fourth, what are its ultimate benefits?
And those four questions, they really give us the entire architecture of the sutra. We can actually walk through them one by one, starting with the very nature of trust itself.
Let's do it.
Because the Buddha begins by laying out 11 distinct characteristics. And right out of the gate, he makes it so clear that this isn't some vague feel-good emotion.
Well,
it is a highly specific, transformative state of being.
Yeah. So the first characteristic he lists is clarity. And it's interesting because he defines clarity by what it eliminates, by what's not there.
Right.
He says clarity is the absolute absence of four stains. And those are hostility, insecurity, apprehension, and doubt.
Mm.
But I want to push on that first one for a second, hostility. Why on earth would a practitioner feel hostility toward the Dharma?
Mm.
We usually associate practice with seeking peace, right?
Well, it makes complete sense if we look at the mechanics of the ego.
Uh-huh.
The great vehicle teachings, and particularly the teachings on emptiness, and the total lack of an independent, inherently existing self-position, they are a direct threat to the ego's survival.
Oh, sure.
When a novice encounters a teaching that fundamentally dismantles their sense of I and mine, well, the ego's first line of defense is often anger. Or, if not hostility, it's insecurity.
Right. Like we tell ourselves, this is too profound for me, or I'm just not built for this level of practice.
Exactly. Or apprehension. We get terrified of what it means to actually let go of our solid sense of reality.
Yeah, that makes sense. But the Buddha is saying that when genuine dadpa, when genuine trust arises, it acts as this powerful clarifying agent.
Yeah.
Those specific defense mechanisms just dissolve. The mind stops fighting the teachings and starts actually resting in them.
And Great Skillful Trust actually questions this. He says, well, how can a novice who is still wrapped up in all this conceptual thought actually achieve this level of clarity and eliminate doubt? Because you can't just think your way out of doubt.
You really can't. The intellect is the very thing generating the doubt in the first place.
Right. So the Buddha's response points directly to lineage and community. He explains that novices overcome doubt through the interest sparked by observing more advanced bodhisattvas.
Aww.
You trace the realization back. You rely on the living proof of the spiritual community to stabilize your own confidence.
It's like, okay, it's like standing on the edge of a frozen lake.
Right.
And you're terrified the ice is going to break.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right, because you can understand the molecular structure of ice intellectually, but that's not going to stop your physical apprehension.
Yeah.
What stops the apprehension is watching someone who is further along walk right out onto the middle of the lake and just jump up and down.
Yes.
You borrow their confidence until your own experience confirms it.
Exactly. You borrow it. And once you take those first steps out onto the ice, you encounter the second characteristic, which is saturation.
The saturation.
The text says that this trust literally saturates the body and mind with peace. It's a profound well-being that satisfies the physical form and the mental continuum entirely.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here for a second.
Go for it.
How is this saturation of peace any different from the happiness we get from conventional things?
Mm.
Like, say, a really good meditation retreat or a beautiful piece of music or even just hitting a deep state of concentration on the cushion.
Right.
Doesn't that also saturate the body and mind with peace?
It does, but the Buddha draws a very sharp line here. Conventional happiness, even the intensely blissful meditative states of the higher form and formless realms, they are still anchored to samsara.
Because they're temporary.
Because they are tied to the subtle apprehension of a self. They depend on specific conditions, whether that's external stimuli or a temporary meditative stabilization. And because they depend on conditions, they are fundamentally unstable. They fluctuate.
Right.
The Buddha actually describes those states as being associated with the disturbances of attachment and anger.
Wow. Because the moment the retreat ends or the deep concentration breaks, the ego scrambles to get it back. The bliss is actually haunted by its own impermanence.
That's perfectly said. The fear of losing the state is baked into the state itself. But the peace born from trust in the great vehicle operates totally outside that economy.
Mm.
It isn't an excited, vibrating elation that eventually crashes into dejection. It's a profound structural integrity. It satisfies completely because it isn't waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Which brings a very visceral physical reality to the third characteristic qualities.
Yes.
The Buddha breaks this into conviction, transformation, and delight. And the text gets incredibly physical when describing this transformation.
It really does.
It says that when bodhisattvas bring these profound teachings to mind, quote, the body hairs stand on end, that there is tingling, and that tears well up and flow from their eyes.
We so often hyper-intellectualize Buddhism in the West. We treat it as just this philosophy of mind. But this sutra insists that realization is somatic.
Somatic, yeah.
Your body recognizes the truth of the Dharma long before your intellect can fully articulate it.
It's a whole body resonance. Like when you encounter a teaching on emptiness that suddenly clicks, or a pure expression of bodhicitta, you don't just nod in polite intellectual agreement.
Right.
You weep. Your actual nervous system reacts to the sheer magnitude of what you're witnessing.
Yes.
And from that visceral reaction comes the fourth characteristic, which is possession. This refers to possessing limitless merit in wisdom.
And the comparison the Buddha makes here is striking. He says, worldly roots of virtue, you know, the things we normally strive for, like a long life, wealth, or even being reborn in a heavenly realm, they don't even constitute a fraction of the virtue born from this trust.
Wow.
Furthermore, he says the bodhisattva's trust surpasses even the transcendent virtue of practitioners who are only seeking individual liberation.
Okay, wait, why? If a solitary practitioner achieves total liberation from suffering, how is this novice's trust still superior to that?
Because of the sheer scope of its intent. The solitary practitioner's realization ends with their own peace. But the bodhisattva's trust is the engine for the liberation of all beings. It's an inexhaustible resource, which seamlessly sets up the fifth characteristic, the basis. Trust becomes the basis for genuine assistance.
And the text uses a pretty challenging analogy here, doesn't it? It contrasts the assistance a bodhisattva provides with the love and affection of worldly parents and friends.
It's extremely challenging because it forces us to look at the delusion that's usually wrapped up in our conventional love. Worldly affection is almost always mixed with attachment and ignorance.
Right.
Like a parent might push their child toward a highly lucrative career that causes immense stress and maybe ethical compromise, genuinely believing they're helping the child secure happiness. We just constantly confuse what is pleasant or secure in the short term with what is actually deeply beneficial.
Yeah, it's that whole just keep your head down, make the money, and be safe mentality, even if the industry is actively exploiting people. It's love, but it's blind. It's enabling samsara.
Exactly. Bodhisattvas, on the other hand, operate with clear-seeing compassion. Their trust allows them to definitively separate the causes of genuine happiness from the causes of suffering.
Right.
So their assistance might not always look comforting in the conventional sense, but it is flawlessly calibrated to actually guide beings toward liberation.
And sometimes that guidance requires going to extreme lengths, which is the sixth characteristic, transcendence. Now, normally we think spiritual practice is strictly about transcending the lower realms, right? Mm. Escaping the hells, the animal realms, the hungry ghost realms.
Yes.
But great skillful trust asks a brilliant question. He asks, how does a novice actually avoid these realms if they haven't fully purified their karma yet?
And the Buddha's answer just flips the entire cosmology on its head. He says that while trust absolutely does protect you from being dragged into lower realms by karma, a bodhisattva might intentionally choose to take rebirth there out of compassion.
Intentionally.
Yes. And when they do, because it is driven by pure aspiration rather than karma, we shouldn't even call them lower realms.
I always think of it like a highly trained rescue diver.
Okay.
Like if someone is trapped in a submerged, toxic cave and they're panicking and hallucinating in the dark, the rescuer deliberately puts on their gear and dives into that exact same dark water.
Right.
From the outside, both the victim and the rescuer are in the same miserable environment. But their experiences of that environment are totally different. The victim is trapped by circumstance, but the rescuer is there by choice. They're equipped with oxygen, a flashlight, and a map out.
The rescuer isn't traumatized by the water. They are utilizing the water to reach the victim. That is a perfect analogy. The sutra explicitly states that when bodhisattvas enter lower realms through aspiration, they do not experience the delusion or the suffering of those realms. Their reality is dictated entirely by their compassion.
That reframing of reality applies to the remaining characteristics as well. So the seventh is root, meaning trust is the absolute seed from which every awakened quality grows. And the eighth is protection, where trust functions as an impenetrable armor.
And that analogy of armor is very intentional. The text says we don't physical armor to protect our bodies from weapons. Similarly, the trust of the awakened mind acts as armor against our own internal adversaries.
The afflictions.
Yes, miserliness, anger, laziness, and distraction.
It's an act of shielding. Like if someone insults you, the ego immediately wants to retaliate. But if your mind is saturated with trust and emptiness and compassion, the insult hits that armor and just drops to the floor. It doesn't penetrate into your mental continuum to plant a seed of anger.
Exactly. And that armor needs to hold up over immense stretches of time, which brings in the ninth characteristic, connection.
Right.
This is the capacity of trust to span lifetimes. The text offers profound reassurance here. It says even if a practitioner dies and takes a new birth where they temporarily forget the Dharma, the underlying habitual tendency of this trust is so deep that they won't give rise to inferior views.
Wow.
The moment they encounter favorable conditions again, the trust fiercely reawakens.
It's literally baked into their spiritual DNA.
Yes.
So rounding out the 11, we have continuity, which is the uninterrupted application of hearing, contemplating, and meditating. And finally, perfection. The trust is perfect because its origin is perfect, its boundlessness is perfect, and it leaves the practitioner perfectly free from regret.
So if we step back for a moment, the Buddha has just given us a comprehensive psychological and somatic profile of trust.
Right.
But knowing what it looks like isn't the same as knowing how to build it, which naturally leads to great skillful trust's second big question. How does one give birth to this trust?
And the Buddha doesn't offer a single magic bullet. He outlines 11 distinct methods. Causes, a companion, examination, behavior, familiarity, absence of weariness, fulfillment, composure, insatiability, solitude, and finally, determining that the teacher is genuine.
We could honestly spend an entire year unpacking just this list alone.
Easily.
But for instance, let's look at the second method, a companion. The Buddha provides a strict diagnostic for identifying a true spiritual friend.
Yeah.
It's not about finding someone who is just, you know, charismatic or agreeable.
Right. It's not a popularity contest.
Exactly. A true companion is rich in scripture, deeply peaceful. They maintain impeccable ethical discipline. And this is so crucial. They have no concern for material gain and they never grow weary of helping others.
You essentially catch the resonance of trust simply by being in proximity to someone who operates with that level of integrity.
Yes.
But where this sutra really gets philosophically intense, where it demands our absolute full attention, is the third method, examination.
This section is arguably the beating heart of the sutra's philosophical instruction. It is a surgical dismantling of spiritual literalism.
Oh, totally.
And to really grasp what's happening here, we need the historical context. This text emerges alongside the Yogacara school of thought, which developed partly to correct widespread misinterpretations of the earlier Madhyamaka teachings on emptiness.
Right, right. So let's unpack that. In the Madhyamaka tradition, the ultimate truth is shunyata, emptiness, meaning phenomena are empty of inherent independent existence.
Yes.
Like a table isn't a table from its own side. It's a collection of wood, nails, human concepts and causes.
Exactly.
But people were hearing statements like, all phenomena do not exist, and they were taking them at absolute face value.
Right. They were sliding straight into nihilism. Because if nothing exists, well then karma doesn't exist, ethics don't matter, and the conventional world is just a meaningless illusion.
I sometimes think of it like reading a map of the ocean. You're holding a piece of dry paper with the word Pacific written on it. If you analyze the paper strictly literally, you'll say, well, there's no water here. The map is dry, therefore the ocean doesn't exist.
Yes.
If you analyze the words phenomena do not exist without understanding what they are actually pointing toward, which is a dynamic, interdependent reality far beyond our rigid concepts, you mistake the paper for the ocean.
And you end up dying of thirst while holding the map. It's tragic. The Buddha issues a severe warning about this. He says that examining the Dharma incorrectly, getting trapped in literalism, makes it completely impossible to develop genuine trust.
Right.
To help us avoid this, he actually details 28 specific wrong views that novice practitioners commonly fall into.
This list of 28 is just a masterclass in spiritual bypassing. It shows exactly how the ego co-opts the language of ultimate truth to justify really unskillful behavior.
It does.
Let's look at the first one on the list, the view of characteristics.
Right. The Buddha says, quote, considering the essence of conditioned phenomena, I declare that phenomena do not exist. But if a practitioner clings to the literal meaning, they turn non-existence into a new characteristic.
Yes.
And start clinging to the idea of nothingness, as if nothingness itself were a solid thing.
They just trade the trap of existence for the trap of non-existence.
Exactly.
And once you fall into that, the ethical ramifications are disastrous. Look at the 10th wrong view on the list. The view of irreproachability.
Oh, this is a classic, deeply relevant trap. The practitioner thinks, well, since everything is ultimately empty and non-existent, bodhisattvas are fundamentally without wrongdoing, even if they commit misdeeds.
Yeah.
They use ultimate truth as a get-out-of-jail-free card for their relative behavior.
We see this in modern spiritual communities all the time.
Absolutely.
That attitude of, it's all an illusion, man, so it doesn't matter how I treat people. The Buddha completely, forcefully rejects this. And the 11th view, the view of escape, is very similar.
Yes, where the practitioner assumes that just holding the intellectual view of emptiness magically excuses them from the ripening of their own karma.
Right.
And what's fascinating is how this intellectual misunderstanding inevitably breeds arrogance. The Buddha outlines the view of contempt and the view of hostility.
Right.
The literalist starts looking down on practitioners of the foundational vehicles who focus on personal liberation and strict ethical discipline. They view those teachings as inferior, and they become hostile, refusing to even associate with those practitioners.
So their so-called advanced view of emptiness has actually just generated division, spiritual pride, and anger.
Exactly.
It's the complete opposite of the clarity and peace we talked about earlier.
And eventually it leads to burnout. The 17th view is the view of pointless fatigue.
Oh, this one is so sad.
It really is. Imagine a practitioner who believes everything is strictly non-existent trying to meditate. They sit on the cushion, their knees ache, and they think, what is the point of this? Nothing exists. No results can be attained. I'm just exhausting myself. And the practice just collapses.
There's also a brilliantly subtle critique in the 20th view, the view of no claim. Because the Madhyamba school famously avoided asserting any philosophical thesis, right?
Sure.
Because any conceptual claim is ultimately flawed.
Right.
But a novice might read that and adopt it as a literal posture. They refuse to take a stance on anything. The text calls this the view of fickleness. They become evasive, thinking their lack of substance is somehow a sign of high realization.
The Buddha gathers all these errors and ironically labels them the great view. And he delivers a profound shock to the system here.
Yeah.
He states that holding these nihilistic, literalist views based on a misunderstanding of the Dharma is actually worse, karmically speaking, than the standard worldly belief in a solid self.
That is a massive statement to make.
It is huge. He says, quote, when bodhisattvas believe that non-Dharma is the Dharma and think that the incorrect is correct, they begin to propagate wrong views. This will make them karmically obscured for an infinitely long period. Actions that oppose the Dharma constitute bondage in the world to a much higher degree.
It's worse because the regular worldly person is just caught in ordinary ignorance, right?
Right.
They aren't actively dismantling the path to liberation.
Exactly.
The literalist is poisoning the medicine itself. So how do we fix it? How do we access the intended meaning rather than just staring blankly at the map?
Well, the text moves us through the subsequent methods. It tells us we need familiarity with the teachings and an absence of weariness. But the real turning point is the eighth method, composure, which means meditative absorption.
Because the intellect built the trap, so the intellect cannot dismantle it. You have to drop beneath conceptuality.
Yes.
The sutra states that through a meditative absorption fueled by faith and joy, the path of tranquility Zinas and the path of insight Lagwinthong finally merge.
And you can't typically achieve that merger while constantly engaged in worldly chatter. That's why the 10th method is solitude.
Solitude.
The Buddha instructs the practitioner to physically step away. He says they should not mingle or cohabit with householders or with the ordained. Instead, they should set up residence in remote areas, aware and diligent.
Wow.
The silence of solitude acts as a crucible. It forces the intellectual understanding of emptiness down into the nervous system as a lived reality.
And what do they do in that solitude? Because they don't just blank their minds, right?
No, not at all.
The sutra introduces the 10 limitless features. This is basically the curriculum of the trusting mind in retreat.
Instead of clinging to a dry thesis of non-existence, the practitioner contemplates the sheer scale of reality.
Right.
They contemplate the limitless Dharma, the sheer volume of teachings, the limitless profundity of suchness, and the limit of reality. They contemplate the limitless statements and terms the Buddha uses, adapting to the minds of different beings.
They focus on the limitless beings trapped in Saisara and the limitless methods used to safeguard them. The text points out that these methods are infinitely adaptable.
Yes.
The Buddha might teach strict logic to a scholar. He might speak harshly to pierce someone's arrogance. He might speak sweetly to comfort someone, or even display miracles, whatever skillful means are required in that exact moment.
And finally, they contemplate the limitless greatness of the three jewels. The text lists seven specific ways the Buddha's greatness manifests.
Okay.
He is the master of all phenomena. His Dharma body is inexhaustible. He's entirely free from misdeeds. His enlightened activity is totally spontaneous, requiring no effort whatsoever. He revels in pure realms. He remains totally unstained by the world, even while walking right through it. And his singular purpose is ripening and liberating beings.
Just imagine the shift in your consciousness. You go into the mountains grappling with doubts and the dry concept of emptiness. You settle your mind in composure, and you actively contemplate this staggering, dynamic ocean of compassionate activity.
Yes.
Emptiness isn't a void anymore. It's the very spaciousness that allows all this limitless compassion to function. That is how the real unshakable trust is born.
And as that trust matures, it naturally goes through phases. Which brings us to Great Skillful Trust's third question. What are the classifications of this trust?
Right.
The Buddha responds by showing that trust is not static, it evolves.
And he gives us four incredibly beautiful natural metaphors for how trust stabilizes in a practitioner's mind. The first one is trust that comes from resting.
Mm.
The Buddha says, consider how water collecting in a hoof print is at first murky, but later clears if it is left undisturbed and calm.
This is such a practical analogy for a novice. When a practitioner gets entangled in temporary worldly activities, you know, stress at work, relationship conflicts, just the noise of daily life, their trust gets shaken.
Oh, absolutely.
The mind gets agitated like mud kicked up in a small puddle.
And the impulse is usually to panic, right? To try and intellectually fix the doubt, which just kicks up more mud. But the instruction is profound in its simplicity. Rest. Free yourself from the attachment. Focus one pointedly on the Dharma, and the mud naturally settles. The water doesn't need to be made clear. Its natural state is clear. It just needs to be left undisturbed.
Exactly. The second metaphor addresses the continuity of lifetimes. It's trust that arises upon birth. The Buddha compares it to beer or fermented drinks that undergo a natural process of change over time to become clear.
Oh, that's interesting.
When a bodhisattva takes a new rebirth, the trust from their previous lives might not be instantly apparent. It takes time to ferment, to mature within the new physical and cultural conditioning, but the process of clearing is inevitable.
The third is trust that emerges at another time. He compares this to rivers that become clear in the autumn. During the monsoon, the rivers are raging, violent, and full of silt. But eventually the season turns, the rains stop, and the water runs crystal clear.
It's a deep acknowledgement of spiritual seasons. You might go through a turbulent period where your practice feels totally obscured. The currents of karma and circumstance are just too strong. But seasons change. The practitioner will reconnect with their clarity as naturally as the earth turns toward autumn.
And the culmination is the fourth metaphor, trust that appears naturally. This is the highest level compared to beryl and precious gems that are intrinsically pure, pulled straight from the earth.
Right.
This represents the non-conceptual state of advanced bodhisattvas. They don't have to cultivate or stabilize their trust anymore. It is the very fabric of their realization.
Beyond these four core metaphors, the text rapidly lists dozens of other classifications, showing just how multifaceted Dadpa is. There is precipitating trust, trust gained by seeing the radiance of a Buddha, trust summoned by resolving doubts, and the profound trust born from observing bodhisattvas who act without regard for their own life or limb. The sutra states, one could not understand their extent even in 1 trillion eons.
Which carries us toward the final movement of the teaching. Great Skillful Trust asks his fourth and final question. What are the benefits of this trust?
And the Buddha doesn't just give a list. He unleashes a cascade of poetic analogies that build to this immense crescendo.
Yeah.
He describes trust in the great vehicle as a jewel without the stains of fear. It's like the moon soothing the heat of suffering. It's a ship filled with jewels crossing the ocean of samsara. It's a bridge, a seed, heavy armor, a panacea, a cloud raining dharma.
Let's unpack the analogy of the bridge for a moment, because the Buddha says trust is a bridge because it takes beings beyond the lower realms and all unfortunate existences.
Yes.
A bridge doesn't eliminate the chasm below it. Hmm. It doesn't pretend the drop isn't there. It provides the structural integrity to cross over it safely. Trust doesn't magically erase the suffering of the world around you, but it gives your mind the stability to traverse it without falling into despair or nihilism.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And he also compares it to a Vajra, the mythical, indestructible thunderbolt diamond weapon. He says it's like a Vajra because it overcomes all the weapons aimed at trust that otherwise threaten to cut the roots of virtue.
What are those weapons? Cynicism, despair, the harsh, overwhelming realities of the news cycle. Our virtues can feel so fragile against the weight of the world. But trust acts as an indestructible core that simply shatters those cynical weapons right on impact.
To ground these poetic images, the Buddha exercises his clairvoyance and tells three specific stories of past lives to prove the power of trust. We started with the story of the hell beings, but the other two are equally profound.
There's the story of the sweeper woman. This takes place during the era of the previous Buddha, Kashyapa. In the very city where they are sitting, Rajaha, there was a woman who was the absolute lowest caste in the village, a sweeper.
Right.
She is tormented by poverty and hunger. She's not a scholar. She hasn't studied emptiness. But she happens upon a courtyard where Buddha Kashyapa and his monks are eating. And she is struck by the sheer grace of their conduct. In a moment of pure, heartfelt aesthetic awe, she exclaims how beautiful and peaceful he is.
It's an unadulterated moment of dadpa. And the text records that she passed away shortly after this encounter. And purely on the strength of that single moment of trust, she was reborn in a higher heavenly realm and eventually achieved complete liberation.
The next story features the opposite kind of person,
A
cynic. During the time of the Buddha Vipassana, there was a Brahmin named Hungry One.
Yeah.
He was naturally distrustful and had absolute zero interest in serving the three jewels. But one day in the city, he sees the Blessed One. And despite all his cynical armor, the sheer physical perfection and presence of the Buddha pierces him. He has one involuntary flash of awe, exclaiming, "Oh, the body of the Blessed Vipassana is beautifully adorned."
A single moment where his cynicism drops. And again, the Buddha states that this fleeting disruption of his ignorance, this flash of trust, was enough to alter his karmic trajectory and secure a higher rebirth.
If a single second of trust from a marginalized sweeper, an entrenched cynic, or a being in agony in the hell realms can reshape their existence for eons, what is the result for a practitioner who actively, deliberately cultivates this trust day after day, year after year?
The Buddha says the merit of that continuous cultivation is literally incalculable. And the sutra brings this all together in a breathtaking final vision. Another bodhisattva named Searching for the Vessel of Trust steps up and asks what practical lived attainments come from this practice. Great Skillful Trust replies by outlining the 10 possessions of the awakened ones.
This is where we see the complete paradigm shift of the Mahayana path. He says that for those who stabilize this trust, the joy of concentration actually becomes their food. The fluid of the sacred Dharma becomes their drink. Tranquility and insight are their vehicle. Conscientiousness and modesty become their clothing. Pure discipline is their ornament.
Learning is their wealth. Absorptions are their perfume. The discourse of Dharma is their music. Their entire reality is sustained by internal spiritual architecture rather than external material consumption. And if they attain these possessions, they obtain the ultimate residence, the palace of the thus gone ones.
The description of this palace is stunning. It is made of the shimmering seven precious substances and shines a light so bright that it pervades the endless extent of the world. Its characteristics transcend the three realms, and it appears from the supreme roots of virtue, leading to liberation through mindfulness, intelligence, and great realization. It is the vehicle of tranquility and insight adorned with limitless masses of the qualities that emerge from great emptiness.
We have to understand that this is not a physical building floating in the sky. This palace is the architecture of an awakened mind. It's a state of consciousness that is entirely impenetrable to harm, inaccessible to demons or disturbing emotions, and constantly reinforced by the joy of the Dharma. To reside in this palace is to have mastered trust.
As the Buddha confirms these words, the text tells us that the 5,000 novice bodhisattvas in the assembly attain a great acceptance of the Dharma. They stabilize their realization. The universe rejoices. Ananda asks for the name of the sutra to preserve it, and the teaching concludes.
If we synthesize everything we've explored today, the defining insight is that trust in the great vehicle is not an abdication of intelligence. It demands the sharpest discernment we possess to navigate between the traps of literalism and nihilism. It requires the courage to seek solitude when the mind is murky, and the radical compassion to return to the world to serve as a basis for the happiness of others. It is the root, the armor, the bridge, and the vajra.
This text wasn't spoken for perfect beings. It was spoken for those of us on the path. Those of us grappling with our ego's defenses, watching our practice get muddy like the hoofprint, and waiting for the autumn rivers to clear. It's a profound encouragement to simply stay the course.
To trust that the natural state of the water is clarity, and to realize that emptiness isn't a dead void, but the very space that allows limitless compassion to operate.
As we bring this Dharma teaching to a close, I want to leave you with a reflection for your own practice. We've seen how this trust isn't just an abstract belief. It's something that physically saturates the body, bringing the hairs on end and tears to the eyes. It constructs an indestructible palace out of emptiness and virtue.
Yes.
How might your relationship to your daily struggles, your inevitable doubts, and the friction of the world shift if you viewed your own hard-won trust not as some fragile belief you constantly have to defend, but as an indestructible palace you already carry within your own mind?
A supreme refuge, built by your own aspiration, available at any moment.
May this exploration of cultivating trust in the great vehicle deeply nourish your path. Thank you for sharing your time, your focus, and your reverence for the lineage with us today.
May your trust become like the autumn river, naturally clearing, and may it serve as the basis for the genuine happiness of all beings.
Until next time.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.